Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. If we haven't met yet, then my name is Claire. I'm a registered nutritionist and I also hold a qualification in exercise science. That's my other degree, natural fertility education and functional medicine. And I have PCOS too, so I know how damn frustrating these symptoms can be. But I also know after 10 years or more of trial and error, how good it can be on the other side when most of those symptoms are in remission and I'm no longer without a period for 3 years, right? Like I have ovulated now every month for the last 5 years. I also know what it's like to not have to deal with acne or unexplained weight gain. For the first time in my life, being able to maintain my weight without really thinking about it. And for you, those symptoms might be facial body hair growth or hair loss. Fatigue was another one that I struggled with. And so many other things that people don't talk about, like blood sugar crashes and severe sugar cravings. Or maybe it's feeling like you need to sleep forever to ever feel refreshed. So my philosophy is that PCOS is a condition that is a combination of your genetics and environment not playing nicely together. Now, PCOS is a genetically driven condition, right? We have the genes that predispose us to PCOS, but your genes don't determine your future or don't determine or aren't guaranteed to determine your future. It's really a matter of the environment has to turn those genes on to make them present. So equally though, we can turn those genes off and not get those symptoms. So what I want to find out is what's affecting your, or what's driving your PCOS. So what systems in your body are not functioning optimally that are causing your body to have these symptoms? And there are a few things that the research shows can really drive this. The main one is blood sugar and our hormone insulin, which controls our blood sugar. The next most common is our stress hormones. The third most common is a thyroid condition and then chronic inflammation, or it can be some other causes as well, but those are really the main things. So for me, and when I work with my patients, the most important thing is to find out what's driving that for you, because then we can then have very specific lifestyle changes that are actually going to work. We're no longer just jumping from diet to diet, hoping that something will work, right? We know what the problem is and we can then put together a solution, right? It's like going to your mechanic and, you know, if you went to your mechanic and said, hey, my car's not starting, you know, if they said to you, we'll order a different motor. And you're like, sorry, excuse me? Like, have you even tried turning it on? Have you looked at it? Have you figured out what could be causing it? And they're like, no, we'll just buy a new motor and see if that works. And you're like, hold on, that's a really expensive way to go about fixing my car. You wouldn't accept that, right? You'd go, right, well, figure out what's going wrong. And that's the same thing as we need to do with our PCOS. We need to figure out first what's going wrong before we can put the right plan in place. Otherwise, we're just using a scattergun approach and hoping that something works. And I think this is something that we don't understand or haven't really thought about, is that changing our lifestyle, like slightly tweaking what we eat or maybe how we move or the vitamins and minerals in our body or how much we sleep, can have a dramatic impact on the way that our hormones work. But if we don't know what to focus on, then we're so scattered and we're just trying to do everything, which is just either not achievable or not sustainable. So this is the way that I work with you and helping you understand what are the most important things you should be doing. And that really is only four or five things. It's not changing your entire lifestyle and diet and getting you to cut out every possible food group under the sun or setting up with unrealistic training expectations where you have to exercise 4 hours a day. You don't have to do that and to see success and see results. And actually people that do tend to do those things like cutting out massive food groups or training 4 hours a day often find that their symptoms get worse because they're so tired and so grumpy that they can't stick with any changes. So I help you through my program, the PCOS Protocol, and this is something that's it's not just a PDF we send you. This is a program that I work with you on. So I'm there every week answering questions from you, doing live calls with you, trying to personalize and change things that you have the maximum effect while we understand what's driving this for you and what changes you need to make. So that's a bit about me and a bit about us. And let's get into the topic for today, though, because that is what you are here for.
So this week, I wanted to share something with you, which is a bit more personal. So it's my personal fertility journey. So I'm currently 20 weeks pregnant. And what I wanted to go through is just what I did to kind of prepare for that, what we did for plan for that, and then talk a little bit about the steps that I took. Given that this is quite personal to me, that I've written a whole book about getting pregnant with PCOS, how I kind of followed my own advice to conceive. And like, we were very fortunate that we were able to conceive the first try, and that's with me being what the medical fraternity classify as a geriatric mother. So I'm over 35, I'll be 36 when this baby is born. And that apparently means that I'm in advanced maternal age, and all the stats show that potentially it should take me a lot longer to get pregnant. But we were very fortunate in that everything was working very well for us, and we actually got pregnant the first try. So I want to talk a little bit about that, the steps that I took prior to conceiving, so that I could make sure what I call in my book my fertile ingredients were all working optimally. And then just a little bit about that age thing and PCOS and why potentially we might have a bit more time up our sleeve than people without PCOS. So as I said, we got pregnant on the first cycle that we tried. And this wasn't luck. This was a lot for years, many, many years of hard work getting my body back working optimally. If we'd tried 10 years ago, then there would have been no way that would have happened, because I wasn't even getting a period. I'd gone for 3 years without getting a period, so I wasn't ovulating. And so therefore what I call my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, Your Fertile Ingredients, my main fertile ingredients of actually producing an egg. The fundamental thing we need to do to produce a baby is produce an egg and have good quality sperm. I wasn't producing that. So 10 years ago, this would have been impossible at the time. And that's, you know, when I got the diagnosis that I have PCOS, and they said to me, you'll really struggle to conceive. They're right. At that time, I would have. But it didn't mean that I would always struggle to conceive if I got my body back working optimally. And that's not that I've been doing that over the last 10 years for the sole purpose of fertility. Gosh, I wasn't even contemplating that. But what I did was get my body back working optimally so that it was working for how I felt, my health, my optimal blood sugar, and making me feel good. And the added bonus side effect of that is that then I was ovulating and I was able to conceive very easily. So in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, I talk about your three main fertile ingredients. So number one is that you've got to have the right ingredients there. And I say that baking a baby is like baking a cake, right? A very simplistic version, but the fundamentals are the same. We've got to have the right ingredients, and quality does matter as well. So the right ingredients, the fundamental ingredients for baking a baby, is an egg and a sperm, right? But just like making a cake, if you try and make, I don't know, try and make a cake with margarine as opposed to butter, it's probably not going to taste that great, right? Or another example would be if you were trying to make meringues, you know, like the egg white and sugar little puffs, or pavlova, which is a very Kiwi dessert, which is again just a larger form of a meringue basically. If you have ever experienced getting a really old egg, and I certainly have because I grew up on a farm where we had our own chickens, and the chickens just used to lay everywhere, so it would be just a treasure hunt to try and find eggs, and you'd often find a stash of eggs and then find out that they were like either rotten or pretty old. But when eggs get really, like hen's eggs get really old, the yolk and the white can sometimes mix. So if you were trying to make a meringue and you were using really old eggs, you wouldn't be able to separate the yolk and the white. And that's a fundamental part of making a meringue. If you try and make a meringue with yolk, it's going to fail because you're not going to be able to form those stiff peaks. So quality is often quite important in the final outcome and even being able to succeed. So in terms of from a fertility perspective, quality of that sperm means whether that's actually going to be able to survive long enough or swim long enough to actually reach your fallopian tubes, which is where the fertilization happens. And if you just quickly bring up on your phone now, your browser, and then just type in female cervical tract or female reproductive tract, you will see in there just actually how much of a distance that sperm has to travel from your vagina, where it's ejaculated, through all the way through the cervix and then up into the fallopian tubes. And sperm and egg meet about midway along that fallopian tube. So you imagine a microscopic sperm having to travel that far is actually like a marathon in the context of how small they are and how far they have to go. So if there's poor sperm quality or motility, so motility is how fast it swims, morphology is how many normal looking bodies there are. If there's poor quality, it's unlikely they're going to be able to make it there or survive very long. So that's when as well the next fertile ingredient, timing, comes into play too. So that's having the good quality sperm is quite important, and having a good quality egg means that often if you have poor quality eggs, then they won't be fertilized as easily, or it'll be what fertility specialists often refer to as a weak ovulation. So although you're ovulating, your body is not producing really good amounts of estrogen, which then leads to poor amounts of progesterone being produced. And then you might have some difficulties in the actual other fertile ingredients, which is the keeping your nest intact to actually keep that fertilized egg safe and nurtured in your uterine lining. Now, the second fertile ingredient is timing. Right, so you've got to actually, same as baking, you know how if you're making, I don't know, you're making a cake and the recipe calls for, you've got to whip the cream, the butter and sugar together to create some aeration, and then you have to sift the flour and the baking powder and the any other dry ingredients together, and then slowly, once you've creamed the butter and sugar together to a cream, you then slowly add the dry ingredients, the flour and baking powder mix, to that creamed butter and sugar, so that the butter and sugar have time to aerate and make it nice and fluffy. And then you're slowly adding and kind of like emulsifying in that flour and baking powder, dry ingredients. If you don't, I'm sure that many of you have experienced, if you don't do that, then generally the result is pretty poor. You might get a really dense cake, or there might be another recipe that you've used where you just kind of read the ingredients and put them all together without reading the method, and then it just was an absolute fail because the method was actually really important to the final ingredient. And that is the same with getting pregnant. The timing is actually crucial in the final outcome of whether you get pregnant or not. So of the many, many days in our cycle that can often, especially if you've got PCOS and long cycles, you can really only get pregnant about 6 days of your cycle. And 6 days is kind of the maximum, because that equates to the time before you ovulate that a sperm could then survive, so that when you ovulate, the sperm and egg could meet, right? So not every day of your cycle is fertile. And so really we need to know when your fertile window is. That's what they call it, fertile window. It's basically the days before you ovulate that we need to be having intercourse. If you do want to get pregnant, you need to be having intercourse so that there's sperm there waiting for your egg to be released. If you wait until after you have ovulated or released an egg, it is too late, right? The egg needs to, when it's released from the ovary, again, if you bring up that image of the female reproductive tract, you'll see that the ovary kind of hangs below the fallopian tube. And so it's got to be released out of the ovary and then up into the fallopian tube, and the sperm and the egg meet about halfway along that fallopian tube, right? So there's got to be sperm there waiting for that egg. Think about this as like a really nice date that comes and picks you up and is waiting at the door for you. So waiting there for your egg to be released, they can then meet and fertilize, and then they travel back down the fallopian tube and then burrow in and implant into your uterine lining. So if you get that timing, so you might be having, many doctors will just say, you need to have sex every day or every second day, right? Which would work for most people in terms of getting pregnant. If you're, that would definitely mean that you're getting your fertile window. But it's also very hard to achieve for most people, especially if you're doing this month after month after month after month. And I just think it sets up very, very unrealistic expectations. And so, you know, across the many, many women that I've worked with, I can tell you not one of them has been able to sustain having intercourse every day for months and months and months on end, right? So it's just completely unrealistic. So instead, we need to identify when your body is, about to ovulate, and so that you can make sure that you're having intercourse at the time that really matters. And then it means that you don't have to worry about it at the other times in your cycle. So in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, I outline how to do this. And the reason we need to know how to do this is because the ovulation predictor kits that other people use to measure their hormone levels when they're ovulating are very, very inaccurate in most people with PCOS. So some people they work for if your hormone levels are working really well, but the majority, they do not work. So they either show you a false positive, so they'll say, yes, you're ovulating when you are nowhere near ovulating, or they will just show negatives all the time, even when you are ovulating or leading up to ovulation, which is the really important thing. So instead, I teach you a method in chapter 9 of my book about using your cervical fluid to identify when you're actually coming into your fertile phase, and then how to use your temperature to confirm that you did ovulate. So both are really important parts, because the temperature, we can't just rely on temperature, because that will only tell us when we have ovulated, and that's too late. And the cervical fluid will just tell us when our body is trying to ovulate. But if you've got longer cycles, so say 35 days plus, it's very likely, almost always the case, that your body would have tried to ovulate a couple of times during that cycle before it actually is able to be successful in doing that. So we really need to know which one was the successful ovulation, because you might have seen the cervical fluid many times in that cycle. And then from there, we can confirm the next part, the next fertile ingredient, which is, do you have a nest that stays nicely intact to allow that little fertilized egg to bake? Or I like, back to the baking analogy, do you have a tin that stays together during the baking process, or does it collapse and then does your cake end up on the bottom of the oven baking, which is obviously not ideal? So the timing is, just like the timing sometimes in baking is really important, the timing in fertility is really important, and often a little bit harder to, just to get right in PCOS. Absolutely not impossible. Once you've got the technique, it's really easy, but it might just take a couple of cycles to understand your fertile window. So obviously, if your cycle is non-existent, then it's likely that you are not producing that egg at all. So going back to that ingredient, that would be where I'd stop, is going, well, there's no point you learning how to do this timing method because you're not really getting a cycle at the moment. So we've got nothing to measure. So the most important thing for you would be getting your body back ovulating. And again, that's what I go through in most of the chapters in the book, actually, is how to identify why your body isn't ovulating. And so this comes back to your root cause, your PCOS root cause, I term it. I don't mean that you caused your PCOS or or even that this is the cause, but this is a thing that we can change, right? These are the environmental factors, like our blood sugar and insulin, our stress hormones, how well our body is coping with inflammation, or is it producing too much, and is our thyroid working optimally as well. And those are the things that can be modified and can make a massive difference on whether your body ovulates and ovulates regularly. And a lot of these stuff is things that you can change at home. You don't have to rely on someone giving you treatment for this. So that's how you would kind of use these steps to know what to triage and what to focus on. So if you're not producing an egg, or if your partner's sperm is really poor quality, then these are the things you can start to work on. Maybe also while you start to work on the following steps as well. So for example, if your partner's sperm is not optimal, but you are ovulating, then you can start tracking your cycle and knowing when you're fertile. And also, the closer you get to knowing when you're fertile means that even if your partner's sperm isn't optimal, you still will likely be able to conceive, because you're then having intercourse very close to when you ovulate. So that if your partner's sperm isn't surviving for a long period of time, because some sperm can survive for 8 days, the average sperm is probably around more like 3 days. But if your partner's sperm is only surviving for a day, or is really struggling with the motility, the swimming part, if you get the timing right, then your body actually produces this cervical fluid, which is the cervical fluid I was talking about there to watch out for when you're fertile. And that stuff, that's what you'll see. You will have likely seen maybe in your underwear as maybe a wetness, or it might look like egg white. Or you might have felt it when you go to the toilet and you wipe with toilet paper and it feels really slippery or feels really wet, but it's not urine, it's something different. That's what cervical fluid is. And that is your cervix releasing this fluid to help basically be like a riptide to help the sperm get up through your cervix to your fallopian tubes, right? So it's kind of like a jetpack or a riptide. It's really helping to, it when you look at it under the microscope, it has a vortex effect. So it really is sucking that sperm up through the cervix into the fallopian tube. And so if you're having intercourse, when you see that cervical fluid, you're giving that sperm a massive helping hand to get up through to the fallopian tubes. And so even if their sperm isn't optimal, the fact that you've got the timing right could be all you need in order to get pregnant. And so then once you've really learnt about this timing, you've learnt, to look out for your cervical fluid, all of the instructions for doing this are in chapter 9 in my book, and you are measuring your temperature so you know when you have ovulated, then you can also make sure that your cycle is good and your hormones are good to support that pregnancy. Now, like I said before, the third and final ingredient is that, do you have a tin to hold that cake and properly bake it, or is your tin collapsing and the cake is falling to the bottom of the oven and baking on the bottom of the oven? And that is, in our case, our uterine lining, right? So as I said, once the egg is fertilized in the middle of the fallopian tube, bring that cervical, that reproductive tract image back up, have a look there how your fallopian tubes connect to the top of your uterus. And you'll see that the egg basically travels back along towards the uterus and then goes down and then implants into your uterine lining. I actually think of the little fertilized egg kind of like burrowing into your uterine lining and making itself a little nest in there. And that's going to be its nest to then grow into a fetus and into a baby. So what this does is that then signals to your body that, hey, I'm pregnant, don't collapse this uterine lining like you normally would when you're not pregnant and then you get a period. It's like, keep me here so that I can keep this little fertilized egg safe and help it develop into an embryo and into a fetus. So normally, if you're not pregnant, your body would get the message to say, hey, not pregnant. So what your body would do is start to drop your progesterone levels, and that would then send the trigger or triggers your uterine lining to collapse away. And that's what we experience when we get a period, right? A period is just our uterine lining the lining of our uterus that is shedding, and that's what the blood is. So when we are pregnant, we obviously want that message to be, don't shed, don't drop progesterone, we're pregnant, we want to keep this intact. But unfortunately, if your body is not producing enough progesterone or for long enough, then it won't get that message. And unfortunately, there's not enough time for that little fertilized egg to travel back along the fallopian tubes and burrow into your uterine lining before the progesterone drops down. And then you get a period, even though there was a fertilized egg there. So this can happen. You can be, technically getting pregnant in terms of the egg and the sperm meeting, but it's not actually have enough time to burrow into the uterine lining, and so you're getting these I guess they could be termed really, really early miscarriages. I don't actually know. You'd have to ask a fertility expert if they would deem that a really, really early miscarriage. But basically the result is that you're not getting pregnant because there's just not enough time for that uterine lining to stay intact there. So this is what we can also determine from when you're charting your, when you're measuring your temperature, is that basically we can then count from when your temperature increases to confirm your body has ovulated to then the first day before your period. And if we have a sufficient number of days, so again, all the instructions are in chapter 9 in my book. If you have enough days there, then we know that actually your progesterone level should be pretty sufficient. Or if it's too short, that's a really clear red flag to us to say, hey, this isn't optimal and you need to address this. And then we can address that through various ways, whether that be through hormone replacement therapy, micronized progesterone, or by just increasing the quality of the egg. Because often this is why your progesterone might be a bit low, is just because that first half of the cycle when your body ovulated and released the egg isn't great, and so therefore it's not producing, again, what fertility specialists would call a strong ovulation, a really good quality egg, and that's then not sending a good message to your body to produce good amounts of progesterone, and why it's collapsing too early. So those are the three fertile ingredients. Remember, good quality ingredients, so in this case a good quality egg and sperm, that we then have perfect timing, because timing is important in baking often. And then we have a good cake mold or nest to keep that fertilized egg safe and to allow it to actually signal to our body that we are pregnant without collapsing too soon. So these are the things that I've been working on while trying to get my hormones back in balance, is that subsequently what's happened is that these things have become much better. So as I said, 10 years ago, wasn't getting a period at all, definitely wasn't ovulating, so I was not producing an egg. And so the first thing is to get back ovulating. And so many of you, if you're on hormonal birth control, you won't know this because you don't ovulate when you're on, say, the combined pill would be a really good example of something that often people with PCOS get put on. The different contraceptive methods work in different ways, and we've got a whole three-part series about how they work and what's helpful for PCOS and what might not be helpful, those that you do ovulate on and those that you don't ovulate on. So if you want to know more about that, go back quite a few episodes. I'll put a link in the show notes for you to those, and you can understand a bit more about how your contraceptive method is working. But if you are on the combined pill, then the way that works as a contraceptive is to shut off ovulation. So you will not be ovulating when you're on that, and so you will not know if your body is actually ovulating, because it's not while you're on it. So if you're on the pill, then you won't be able to do this test. But if you're not on the pill, then if you are not getting a regular cycle, so if you're not getting a period at all, it means that your body is not able to ovulate. So it will still be trying to ovulate in most cases. It just won't be successful. And so it will keep trying and trying and trying. And so again, if your cycle is more like 50 or 60 days, that's what will be happening. It's not that your body's not doing anything. It is trying to ovulate, but it's just not successful it might need 6 or 10 goes before it's able to ovulate. So that's what it means when you're getting a really long cycle. And that would be the first thing to try and fix. Now, if you are getting a period, if you are ovulating at all, then it you can get pregnant even if your cycle's 40, 50, 60 days long. And I have had this. I mean, gosh, I think, just trying to remember, I think it was Sarah who was episode 9. She was in the protocol program with me. And I think off the top of my head, yeah, I think it was episode 9. But she got pregnant on the very first time her body ovulated. So she hadn't had a period for ages. And the first ovulation she picked up and she was actually able to get pregnant. So just because your cycle is long doesn't mean that you won't be able to get pregnant, but it just might mean that the quality of that egg is not great, and therefore it might make it a little bit harder, especially to have good progesterone and that good cake mold to keep everything safe once your egg and sperm do meet. So that would be the first thing I would work on. Then if you are getting a period, so say you're getting one every, you know, approximately 40 or 50 days, then you could start doing the timing technique. So starting to look for cervical fluid or feel for cervical fluid and noting that down in either in like just on a document. I've in the book, I give you a link to just one like a PDF that I've created for you, so you can print that out if you prefer to have like a printable version, or you can just use a period tracking app. I quite like the simple one, Fertility Friend. It's a little bit ugly, but it does the job and it doesn't try and do too much interpretation, which I find really unhelpful from most of the apps. Their algorithms are wildly inaccurate in terms of when you're actually ovulating, and they'll give you, in most cases I've seen anyway, not accurate answers about when you're actually fertile. But you can just at least use the something like Fertility Friend to just pop in the days you're seeing that cervical fluid. And then also you can start measuring your temperature every morning and recording that in your app as well to see, and you'll be able to, the good thing about the apps is that they graph it for you so you can see when your temperature rises. And again, follow the instructions in chapter 9 of my book about how to measure your temperature, because there's quite specific instructions, and then also how to interpret those measurements as well. So then the third step was, once you're doing that, then you can actually identify if there's a what's called a luteal phase defect, which is what I was meaning before about the progesterone dropping off too quickly and you're getting a period before that little fertilized egg has a chance to implant into your uterine lining. So those are the three most important things that you can do to assist your fertility, and you can do these at any point in your life, right? You don't even have to be trying to then know, okay, do I have, am I ovulating? When am I fertile in my cycle? And then do I have a sufficient luteal phase? And those are things that are helpful for you just feeling good and your body working optimally and knowing that your body is working optimally, not just for fertility, but just for your health. And if you've got these, you're 80% of the way there in terms of fertility. I mean, 80% is an arbitrary number. It could be 98% for all I know, but that's the really crucial things. And so people saying, oh, you've got PCOS, you're going to struggle to conceive, is absolutely bullshit, right? The only thing about having PCOS is that you may be more likely to have problems ovulating that you then can work on to fix, right? And whether you work on those through lifestyle modification or whether you use pharmaceutical help like letrozole or micronized progesterone, which is a bioidentical hormone, this can be fixed, right? You're not missing any sexual organs. You are not infertile. You might just be suffering from subfertility at the moment because one of these fertile ingredients isn't really working as optimally as what it should do. And so, but if you get them working optimally, then you are most of the way there in terms of from a fertility perspective. Then the other, you know, like things that can go wrong, I do mention these at the end of my book as well. Well, what happens if you are, if these fertile ingredients are all working properly and you've been trying for many months now and you know that you've been timing correctly and following all the instructions, then well, where do you look next? And that's where more complicated things like autoimmune issues or genetic issues can crop up as well. Maybe endometriosis and a blocking of the fallopian tubes. And that still can happen, but it's much less, well, it's much more rare, much less common, and in terms of the number of people it affects, and is much harder and much more time consuming to diagnose all these problems. So I wouldn't really recommend that someone go and get all of these tests well before they're wanting to conceive. I'd just say actually give the, like, focus on the really important things first, the fertile ingredients, and then you need to be trying for at least probably 6 to 10 cycles. This varies by age. So if you're getting everything perfect, you still only have about a 10 to 20% chance of conceiving on that cycle. So if you're in your earlier 20s, you have a much higher chance of conceiving. If you're in your mid 30s or even 40s, that probability goes down. Potentially, I think in your 40s, it might even be potentially down to about 5%. Later 30s, probably more like 10%. I can't remember the exact stats. I'm sure you can find them. I'm sure I've also got them in my book somewhere. But just to give you some idea about, and the reason for that we think is probably egg quality. And so even though things might be timing perfectly, the quality of the egg's just not quite there. But this is why I was very lucky that for me, even though I probably only had a 10% of chance conceiving on that cycle, that worked for me. Or maybe because of the work that I've done over the years, my egg quality was actually much better than what my age predicted, and therefore I was at, you know, more like 20% chance. So I would do those, so I would do that first, and then once you kind of get to, so say you're like me in your mid 30s, you might need to say 10 tries, 10 ovulations, 10 cycles. And if you're still not conceived by then, that would be when, okay, time to move on now, right? There's not really much point continuing down this route because we should have conceived by now. It's time to look and see if there's anything else going on, like maybe getting a gynecologist or a fertility specialist to make sure there's no blockages in your fallopian tubes, maybe getting some blood work done to have a look at autoimmune factors. And this is where working with someone who's skilled in this area is really important because they should know what to look for. I didn't do any of these tests before we tried to get pregnant, mostly because you can end up going down a rabbit warren and looking at every possible scenario that could happen when it's, you know, the likelihood of that happening is quite low. And so I really would prefer to go through the phase of at least knowing, well, I'm 80% there, let's try. And then after, you know, the number of cycles that we determine based on age, then going, okay, right, now is the time to look further if it's still not happening then. But even though I know all this information and I would have access to go and, you know, pay for these tests, I chose that it wasn't worth it for me until we'd actually tried a few cycles. And that's definitely what I'd recommend other people do as well. Even if you're the type of person that just wants to know everything, there is so many things to look for that it's almost, well, it's not impossible, but it would be very time consuming and possibly more stressful to do that than what it would to just start, you know, just start trying, especially when you've got the other fertile ingredients sorted. So I didn't do that. What I did do though was, over the last, you know, many years, and I had the benefit of knowing that I had PCOS many years ago and getting the symptoms when I came off the pill of not having a period, of having acne and unexplained weight gain that led to the diagnosis of PCOS. I know this is not everybody's experience. Your experience might be that you've only been diagnosed when you've started to try, and therefore you don't have the benefit of time on your side. However, I would say that, although for me this was many years ago, in terms of how my body responded to changes, didn't take 8 years, right? It took more like, you know, could, for many changes it was 6 months, for additional changes it might have been up to a year. But your body can respond quite quickly in many instances. And also too, when it's not responding, there is the, you know, being able to use a combination of lifestyle treatment and medications like letrozole, which are brilliant for PCOS as well. So you have the option of using both. You don't just have to go down the lifestyle route. But for me, what was really important in terms of getting back ovulating was identifying why my body wasn't ovulating. In my case, it was because my insulin, my hormone that controls my blood sugar, was way too high. So that, if you read chapter 2 and 3 of my book, you'll understand how insulin disrupts the hormones that control our ovulation. And when I improve my insulin through improving and changing my diet, so even though I was a qualified nutritionist, I was an elite athlete, I was eating quote unquote well by all measures, it was not optimal for my body and my insulin. So when I started eating for my insulin and also exercising for my insulin, made sure I had good vitamin and mineral levels, then my body responded by ovulating. And as I said, this can happen quite quickly. I don't know exactly how long it took my body because I was a lot of trial and error as well, but it wasn't years, it was a matter of months. And again, if yours is taking longer, then there's the things like letrozole that can help to, or micronized progesterone is another way as well to help that speed that process up too. So if time is not on your side, or you have been trying for many, many, many months already and you're not willing to wait much longer, then there are other medications that can help you get there faster if that's what you want to do. I always say to my woman that that's their decision to make, that, you know, you don't ever think that you have to do everything wholly like natural. If you actually are so over this process, then by all means, there are some really great fertility treatments out there. But I always recommend that you also combine them with lifestyle treatments, treating that root cause as well, because it will likely make the fertility treatment more successful and also mean that you have a healthier pregnancy and a healthier baby as well. But it doesn't mean that you can't do that. I was not trying to conceive at the time when I was figuring this stuff out, so I wasn't going to be using fertility drugs to control this, but I was using more lifestyle treatments. So insulin was one big thing, and then stress hormones was another. So again, and this took longer, much, much, much longer actually, especially for me because I was an endurance athlete, and I refused to see how the level of exercise that I was doing could be negatively impacting my body. I was like, exercise can't be bad. Surely it can't be bad. But in my case, just because of what I was doing and what the other parts of my lifestyle looked like in terms of what I was doing for a job, what other projects I had on, I was renovating rental properties, I was doing, I was getting ready to move overseas. All of that combined meant that my stress bucket, and this is the analogy I use in my book, my stress bucket was overflowing, and that was not helping either my body ovulate optimally, and nor was it helping my insulin work properly as well. So once I got those two things sorted, then that really helped me get my fertile ingredients back working. So I was producing an egg, I was ovulating regularly, and then my luteal phase was sufficient as well. The other things I made sure that I did as well leading up to fertility and throughout the last few years is making sure that I had really good levels of the critical nutrients that would help my body function optimally. So by nutrients, I mean micronutrients, so vitamins and minerals. So I made sure that I had good amounts of the vitamins that would help me to produce a good quality egg, and that I had good amounts to help my insulin work properly, because micronutrients are essential cofactors, they're called, essential parts of pretty much every reaction in our body working properly. And if we don't have enough, then it might mean that those reactions don't happen as often as what we'd like or as fast as what we would like. So for example, if you don't have enough iron in your body, then your body will probably prioritize the essential things like your essential organs like your heart and lungs and everything. But ovulation is not essential, right? It is one of our top desires after survival, but it's not essential. So our body can switch off ovulation if it doesn't think that we have the resources needed that we need to sustain both our life and a fetus life as well. So same thing with hair, right? Like our hair is a dead mass of protein, but it needs iron to grow properly. So why, if we don't have enough iron, our body is going to divert iron away from our hair and divert it to much more essential functions. And we can get, consequently, hair that falls out or is brittle or breaking. And the number of women that I see coming to me for PCOS and hair loss, that's not really much to do with PCOS, but instead is to do with the fact that their iron is super low, or just not super low, but maybe just not optimal, is very, very, very common. So I made sure that I had really good amounts of these nutrients, but also not too much of the nutrients that were going to be potentially toxic in my body. So iron is also one that can, if it's too much, it can be toxic. And for people with insulin resistance, this is often the case. So for me, I actually tend towards the higher end of iron. So I need to make sure that my iron stays low. Otherwise, it will make my insulin, or could make my insulin resistance worse. And so I've been measuring that and fixing that over the last few years as well. And we did a podcast on iron, the effects of low iron and high iron a few weeks ago, which you can scroll back to. I would say that of the people that I see, 30% would have low iron, about 40% would have normal iron, and 30% have too much iron, which can be detrimental. So very common in PCOS. I also made sure that I had good vitamin D levels. Now, vitamin D is crucial for our insulin to work properly. It's also just crucial for energy and how we feel and vitality. And if you're like me and you live far from the equator, so I live in New Zealand, which is pretty much the closest country to Antarctica alongside Argentina. We're far from the equator. And so in the winter here, because of the way that the earth moves around the sun, is that the sun's rays are not at an angle that can actually convert vitamin D in my skin. So I think this is a big misconception. A lot of people say to me, oh, but I get out in the sun a lot. I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't matter if you get out in the sun in the winter. The angle of the sun's rays are not at a level where your body's going to, they're going to convert vitamin D in your body. So it's really not going to be effective. To get enough sunlight to convert vitamin D in your skin, you really have to be outside for about half the time it takes to turn pink. So in New Zealand here, in the middle of winter, I could be out in the sun all day and I would nowhere near get burnt, right? Or turn pink. And so therefore, that's a really good sign to me that I'm not going to get my vitamin D requirements from the sun alone. I have to supplement. So the same thing as if you have darker skin. If you can be out for hours and hours and hours or never ever burn, then you're also, it's showing that you're more likely at risk of vitamin D deficiency, even if you live quite close to the equator. Also, if you have chronic inflammation in your body, then your body's going to find that really hard to convert vitamin D from the sun. Or maybe it's going to find it really hard to absorb vitamin D in your gut from supplements, and you might need a combination approach. But really, for anyone that's living far from the equator, just I think a rule of thumb is that you're not going to get enough vitamin D from the sun during winter, and you will have to supplement at least 2,000 IUs a day. But the research for PCOS supports that you might need more like 4,000 IUs a day to maintain your levels through winter. So if you're vitamin D deficient, that probably means you need more than that. So I always get my people to get a test done first, and then we look at what level they actually need. If their levels are good, then we're just trying to maintain them through winter. But if they're deficient, we're trying to increase, or maybe not deficient, but just suboptimal, we're trying to increase them into the optimal range and then keep them there. So dosing, there's not one size fits all, but a good rule of thumb is that if you can't get a test, then during the winter, 2,000 to 4,000 IUs is the recommended. So it's 2,000 is the safest level for most people. But just be aware that it still might not be enough. So getting a test is ideal. You definitely don't want us to be taking lots, because vitamin D can build up to toxic levels in your blood. So if you've been taking high dose, so say 10,000 IUs for many, many, many months, then you could have toxic levels of vitamin D. So again, stop that immediately. Go and get a test, and then know whether you need to decrease that or completely stop, or just decrease your dose significantly. And then the other vitamin levels that you can test for that are really important for fertility and for our insulin and many other functions in our body, our stress hormones, is our B vitamins. So B12 is an important one, really important as well for baby's growth too. So having good levels going into pregnancy is really important. And folate is the other one. Again, you probably heard about, because folic acid is the hot topic when it comes to when you do get pregnant or in a prenatal. So folate is the natural form found in your body, and we want to make sure that you have good levels, ideally going into pregnancy. And that's why a lot of prenatals contain folate or folic acid to try and give you good levels. But it's not just about making sure that the baby develops properly in terms of the neural tube forming properly in the baby. It's actually really important for so many of your processes to work properly, like your insulin and stress hormones as well. So we want to make sure that you've got good levels well before we even think about fertility too. So those are the steps that I've taken over the last few years. And again, it doesn't need to take a few years. It's going to be literally a matter of months that you go through this process. All of these steps are outlined in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS. So if this is something on your radar, or you just want to understand how fertility and PCOS works more, or you want to get back ovulating just for your own health, then those steps are also entirely relevant for you as well. One last thing I just wanted to touch on before we wrap up is age. So I have heard many people being told when they get diagnosed with PCOS, you've got PCOS, you shouldn't wait to have a child. You should get onto this as soon as you can. And I just wanted to say that this is terrible advice. I entirely disagree with this. I don't think it's evidence-based at all, for one. And also, two, I think that it fundamentally goes against everything we should be doing in health, and the understanding that person's circumstances and giving them the right advice in the context of that person as well. So telling a 22-year-old that, who's not looking to have a baby anytime soon, may actually alter the course of her life forever because of that information that you gave her. And so really I think that we really need to stop listening to this, or really call someone out if they're telling you this and being like, hold on, why are you telling me this? Why is this relevant to me? Like, you haven't even asked if that's what I want at the moment, or if I want that at all. And instead, looking at the evidence, which actually for the evidence in terms of maternal age and the optimal time for maternal age is that our optimal fertility is when we're in our 20s. No doubt about that, in terms of that the time it takes to get pregnant. As I said before, your probability of getting pregnant on any cycle that everything is working perfectly for is much higher in your 20s than what it is in your 30s or 40s. However, it doesn't mean that it's not possible later, or that, you know, in my case, just as easy in your mid-30s or what it would have been in your early 20s. And I think that the context needs to be given. So I want you to understand that while it may take a shorter period of time in your 20s, it does not mean that it's not achievable in your 30s or even 40s. And the research for people with PCOS may indicate that we actually have longer fertility than people without PCOS. Now, I would say that the research on this is absolutely not clear at the moment. Of the studies that have been done, a few show that we do have better fertility for longer compared to people without PCOS, but other studies show that there is no difference. While there hasn't been what's called a systematic review, which looks at all the research and then groups those numbers, and then it can do an analysis based on the bigger number of all those pooled studies as opposed to just one individual study on its own, there hasn't been one of those that I can find yet. But just looking at the basis of the studies that have been done, I personally would say that there's probably more studies that show a positive relationship with PCOS and extended fertility than there is showing no positive association. So while I would say it's totally inconclusive at the moment, it is looking to be positive for us that we may maintain fertility for longer. But if it's something that's really important for you, then I wouldn't bank on that information. But for those, I think it's just a nice thing to see that actually it certainly isn't any worse than other people, which is what I do hear people with PCOS being told, is like, you should get onto this as soon as possible. And I just think that that is, it's not accurate. It's not actually evidence-based. It's not showing we have worse, like, age-related fertility. So getting onto it earlier is not, it's not the thing. And instead, the advice should be, okay, well, this is what you have. This is what it could mean if you are not producing these fertile ingredients, but this is very much fixable, and this is how we can actually help you get back ovulating, either on your own or with fertility treatment. And I think knowing the context of that, and also understanding where that person is in their life, are they, you know, do they even have a stable relationship? Are they interested in fertility? Is this something that's even on their radar? Is giving them the advice in the context, as opposed to just, giving them, maybe scaremongering them into making a decision that they otherwise would not have made at that age. So instead of listening to people telling me that I had PCOS and therefore I'd struggled to conceive and I should get onto it early, I was ignoring that advice and instead I was waiting for a time that both I and my partner were ready to conceive, right? And that is, for me, that's been in my mid-30s. So as I said, I'm 35 now. I'll be 36 when this baby is born. And it certainly hasn't impacted my fertility, given that I was able to conceive in the first cycle of trying. Now, we'll never know what caused this, whether that came down to all the work I've put in over the last decade to get my body back functioning optimally, or potentially whether I do actually have better advanced fertility in later life because I have PCOS. But regardless of either of those, I would not have made a different decision based on those factors alone. I made the decision based on when I was ready to have a baby and when my partner was ready to have a baby. Nothing else. And the other thing I was certainly not doing was getting a fertility test to quote unquote check my ovarian reserve or check my fertility. These are often branded as fertility warrant of fitnesses or to check how long your fertility is going to last for. And the reason I was not doing that is because they are not evidence-based, and I think that the psychological effect that can have on people is potentially pretty detrimental. So the current research that has assessed all of the evidence behind using especially this hormone called anti-Müllerian hormone. So anti-Müllerian hormone is a hormone that's often used to try and assess how many eggs you have left. So the current thought is that people that are born with ovaries are born with the total number of eggs that they will ever have, or follicles that they will ever have in their life. And that just declines steadily with age, or not maybe not steadily, but just declines with age. It never goes up again. And so an AMH test is supposed to be able to test to see how many eggs you have left and therefore how long your fertility is going to last for. So the higher AMH score, the longer your fertility will last. The lower AMH score means, oops, you're potentially bordering on menopause and you better, if you want to have a baby, you better do this quickly. But unfortunately, that test is not accurate, right? And so inaccurate to the point where I think bordering on unethical to be promoting this to women to kind of test their fertility. In a latest review of that, which I think was done in 2019, the author concluded and said, based on the current data, AMH cannot reliably be used to predict those who may have difficulty conceiving or the timing of an individual's menopause transition. If the test is being ordered in this context, care must be taken to ensure the patient understands the significant limitations that affect the interpretation of that result. And while I think that fertility centres are also potentially counselling people to say, hey, we don't know for sure, but they're also saying this is the best test we have. But the best test we have and one that is, well, how actually accurate is it, are two very different things, right? So you could say, oh, well, this is, yeah, we don't really have any further information, but this is the best we have, so we'd recommend you best get onto this and maybe freeze your eggs or something else, is, slightly unethical, I find. Especially because they have found that AMH can be a good predictor of how your body is going to respond to stimulation. So if you're getting, say, letrozole, how your body is going to respond to that drug, but not as an overall test to look at how potentially fertile you are, or how long it might take you to conceive, or when you might stop ovulating. Instead, I think a far better approach is to work on, or just to analyze those fertile ingredients. So have a look and just go, right, well, are you ovulating at the moment? If you're on the pill, okay, we can't probably tell that, but do you want to come off the pill and just see how you go, whether you do start ovulating again, or maybe how long it takes? Because you might have been put on the pill at a very young age and never ovulated, and it might take you longer to get that ovulation back. That's going to be a far better predictor of your fertility than an AMH test is going to be. And so I would much rather look at those really crucial things that we know are just essential for getting pregnant, as opposed to an arbitrary blood test that in the evidence shows is not accurate for testing your ovarian reserve, or how many eggs you have left is basically what it's trying to tell you, and therefore how long it is until you go through menopause. While you are still ovulating, you can still get pregnant, right? That's while you're still producing an egg, you haven't gone through menopause yet, you can still get pregnant. And so we really want you to understand that. Now, I'm not saying don't go and freeze your eggs, absolutely do whatever you want to do, but just understand that that test is not particularly accurate or accurate at all for determining your ovarian reserve, how many eggs you have left, and or just your fertility. Because I think that's really what women want to know is there something wrong here? Is there something I need to address and fix before I want to try and conceive? So maybe you're in a stable relationship, but you're not ready to have a baby yet, but you're thinking maybe in 2 or 3 years' time. An AMH test is not necessarily going to be the best thing that you can do. A better thing would be, okay, are my fertile ingredients working properly? And if not, giving yourself that time to get them back working before you start trying. So while you've got these 2 years up your sleeve, that's the brilliant time to start trying to get your body back ovulating, making sure that your egg and sperm quality is good, making sure that you know when you're fertile in your cycle. And it doesn't mean that you have to just not use contraception at all. There are many forms of non-hormonal contraception that can help you while you're doing this process. So I outline all of that in the book, and I think that's probably, I can't cover all of that in the hour podcast that we're doing today, hence the reason I did write the book. You can also listen to the book on audiobooks now as well. So it's on all audiobook platforms, Audible, Apple Books, Kobo, pretty much anywhere you can get audiobooks, it is there. And that might be a better way for those of you that are busy to actually digest and listen to this content, as opposed to having to sit down and like read this content as well. But all of the information is there to actually dive deeper into this area, which I think is far more important than making decisions about your future using a test like AMH, which doesn't have the evidence backing to actually stand behind it as a good test to test your fertility at the moment. So that's all I did. As a wrap, like the things that I outline in the book is everything that I did in order to get pregnant the first cycle at 35, at advanced maternal age. I didn't go into all of the additional things in the final chapters around checking around autoimmunity and endometriosis, because as I say in the book, the most important thing is actually getting those fertile ingredients first and then trying for 6 cycles or possibly a few more. And at that stage, if it still hasn't worked for you, then moving on to, well, what's next? What can we do? What could be potentially going wrong here? But I didn't go through all of that. And so I'm saying to you that you don't need to go through all of those things either. The most important things is really checking and making sure that your fertile ingredients are working properly. And if they're not, then using the five-step process that I put in place in the book to help those fertile ingredients get back working properly again. So I hope that this has helped you, and just see a little bit about the process that I went through and why I wrote the book, in terms of that was the things that I were thinking about and what I do with all of my patients. I've done it no differently for myself, and just that if you're going through that process, it can be very effective. But also too, for some people, you may choose to use more medical intervention, or you may need to, and that's not a failing or a failure whatsoever. It's just where you are at. But I also always recommend that you address those lifestyle factors as well, address that root cause, because it can make the fertility treatments potentially more successful, and it can also mean a happier, healthier pregnancy. And I will also go through in the following episodes a bit about my first trimester and some learnings from that, what I've experienced myself, things like food aversions and nausea and constipation and all those wonderful things that many of us suffer from, how I kind of managed and navigated those while also trying to keep as healthy as possible, and then also second trimester learning from those too. So if you want to get more information about my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, as I said, it's available on all audiobook platforms if you want to listen to it, or if you want to get the paperback version, that's available through Amazon. And also the Kindle version as well was available through Amazon too. So you can order those there. Or if you're in New Zealand, you can order through Amazon Australia, or you can order directly off our website, which is thepcosnutritionist.com. It's also available in many Paper Plus bookstores around the country as well, if you want to grab it directly from the bookstores. So thanks so much for tuning in. We will catch you next week. Bye for now. Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.